So, what was all that about? Before we've even had time to wish you a happy new political year, Westminster has witnessed one of its passing but fierce storms. From out of the blue, Jeff Hoon and Patricia Hewitt called for Gordon Brown's head, but before long, most of their colleagues were instead demanding the blood of the treacherous too. And with us to try and make sense of the mayhem, we have our sage and seasoned Brown watcher, Jonathan Friedland. Tom Happold, who's our multimedia supremo and a long-term and serious political junkie, and down the line from Westminster, so she can give us the latest from the heart of Labour's sorry battle, we have our very own Allegra Stratton. Hello, my absent friend.
Hello.
Oh, she's very cold, apparently, this morning. But before we try and make sense of the aftermath, though, let's remind ourselves of what the plotters thought they were up to. Our political correspondent, Nick Watt, got the agenda straight from the mouth of Jeff Hoon yesterday.
The Labour Party is simply not getting its message across. We're not able to campaign successfully and effectively, because every time we launch a campaign, every time we take an initiative, put forward a policy, continuing questions about the leadership arise. And Patricia Hewitt had the same experience talking to colleagues over the recess, and we felt that it was necessary to try and resolve these matters once and for all.
And is the problem just that there are Labour members talking about the leadership, or is there a problem with Gordon Brown?
I think it's about making sure that we can go into the general election campaign as a united party. We set out absolutely specifically in our letter to parliamentary colleagues the fact that if those who have been questioning the leadership were to lose such a secret ballot, then we would expect them to unite behind the leader, to campaign as a united party, and to win that general election. So this is all about making sure these questions are resolved once and for all.
So, Allegra, that's what the man affectionately known as Buff Hoon hoped to achieve. Can you tell us one day on what he actually did?
Well, he's upset a lot of people. The arguments against what Hoon and Hewitt did are the following: that it came after a Prime Minister's questions that had seen Gordon Brown happy, relaxed, and landing lots of blows on David Cameron about, for instance, his U-turn, a perceived U-turn on their marriage tax proposals.
Polls narrowing a bit as well?
Polls narrowing 5 months before an election. What the hell are they thinking? It seems that they decided quite, or rather, I understood that Jeff Hoon was going to do something quite a long time ago. But Hewitt's entering into the mix. We know she's a Brown critic, but we didn't know that she would team up with him. Anyway, it seems like they decided quite a long time ago, and that this was a sort of rigid, dare I say it, quote unquote, plot. Except I don't think we can really call it a plot, but it was a rigid plan, and that maybe the critics are saying it should have been junked as they saw Brown's performance improve over the Christmas period and this week. That said, in politics, there are never good times to do things. As their letter says, the one that they emailed to people yesterday at 12:30, straight after Prime Minister's questions, there's massive divisions in the Labour Party about this question. It's a little bit disingenuous, as Patricia kept saying, to say, well, you know, if you support Gordon Brown, this is your opportunity to say it. This was another attempt to have a secret gauge of the level of unhappiness with Brown's leadership. I have to say, the specific attempt looks like it's going nowhere, but we, The Guardian, do understand that there are further meetings taking place, and I think it is completely wrong to say that that it is over.
Blimey. So I'm pleased we've got our Westminster arm covering this. are you expecting government resignations?
No, but important people who have not spoken out so far are having conversations and are doing massive amounts of soul searching.
Isn't the real problem here, though, that Brown has been slightly narrowing the polls, he's staked everything on the economy, the economy's looking quite good, and these people who are moaning, it's not clear what their argument is, apart from they don't think he's the one to get the message across. And this close to an election, it'll look cynical, wouldn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. I mean, if you were to take off our impartial sort of journalist hat and sort of appraise what they did yesterday, it for me had none of the elements that were lacking 6 months ago when they tried last. And I mean, it had a little bit of surprise, and that wasn't true the last time round. And I know that Jeff Hume would not want to be called a Blairite. I know that he's not a Blairite. But for me, they are not unusual suspects. They are people that are known critics, and they were not the sort of names that would encourage those elements of the Parliamentary Labour Party, and indeed wider party across the country, to come out and to support a move against Brown. Those are groups that we know want Brown to go. It's just that they just don't know the strategy to bring it about, and they also believe it has to come with a huge policy programme attached. And that was lacking yesterday, and it was, you know, just as an observer, quite sort of a wearisome day.
Tom, we're sat here obviously away from the hubbub of it all in King's Cross. Do you believe that this could get any more momentum looking on from a distance?
I find it hard to believe now. You know, it was all very exciting yesterday, but it seems, you know, the plot seems to have lasted less time than the snow. You know, to call it a Blairite plot is to give it a sort of flattery that perhaps it doesn't deserve. They seem to lack a plan, and they also seem to lack a clear, identifiable replacement for Brown. Mm. Yep. You know, who does one feel in one's heart if they suddenly became leader, that you would think that would improve the position of the Labour Party?
Johnny?
Well, that's certainly true. That's always been the problem for any anti-Brown effort, that firstly, there isn't a single candidate, and second, there's no polling evidence to suggest that person would bring a bounce. And those would be the two conditions that, if they were there, would really project and kick off any kind of coup attempt. And if you think about it, the only time where Labour has come even close to pushing out a leader after a fashion was the attempt against Tony Blair, which made Tony Blair announce his stepping down ahead of schedule.
That was a Brownite one, and that was they know how to organise plots.
Exactly. The only people who can do it, who can do, you know, show the Labour Party how to get rid of Gordon Brown, is probably Gordon Brown himself, because he's actually done it. But the point was, he was the leader in waiting. Not only a leader in waiting, but a full machine in waiting and in operation. I mean, you know, Hoon and Hewitt seem to have been really lone outriders. They don't seem to have coordinated with the key people. Many people who should not have been surprised by the letter were surprised by it. You know, the Brown team absolutely never made mistakes like that. They planned, they coordinated, they had people in place, everything was choreographed.
And
so in the absence
of
a plan,
that,
a candidate, polling evidence, etc., you know, the chances of this working were always against it. Add to that, there was some very specific on-the-day incompetence. A plot, you know, a plot without a plotters without a plot. So it was probably always, you know, doomed, if not anyway, certainly a very uphill challenge. They
can I just some brief words in their defence?
Valiant.
Indeed. Here we go. It took 7 hours for the Foreign Secretary to come out, and even then he issued the tersest of words of support.
Well, actually, Allegra, I'll pick you up on that. I don't think it was words of support. Sorry, I'm just ruffling through the paper.
No, it wasn't words of support.
It was, I work closely with him. Not even I work closely with him, but I work closely with him on foreign policy issues. Well, that's news for the Foreign Secretary.
Well, indeed, Tom, this is what I think is so... reflects quite badly on our profession. We just have to watch and wait and see, because nothing in the words of the most of the most important people who spoke out yesterday should lead us to suggest that this
but
is
that really illustrates
over.
The problem, doesn't it? That seems to me it illustrates the problem. The critique of Brown is not fundamentally one based on policy or strategy. It's one based on his tactics and his day-to-day management of the political engagement with the opposition. And nobody seems to have a killer instinct or the ability to land blows on anyone in the government. The two candidates, Johnson and most woefully David Moribund, seem utterly incapable to actually strike.
Well, except that they're haunted, aren't they, by the most famous time this happened, 1919, the Tories, with a person who did strike, who did have the nerve, Michael Heseltine. Thereby, he triggered the process, he got rid of the incumbent, but he was denied the crown himself. It's now the absolute cliche of Westminster sort of talk, Heseltine's law. And both
Indeed,
Alan Johnson...
Miliband made it so, didn't he?
Yeah.
Because he was overheard in that lift.
He explicitly referred to it. As Allegra says.
But Heseltine's law...
So therefore, Alan Johnson can't do it, Dave Miliband can't do it, Jack Jack Straw can't do it. Any Harriet Harman can't do it. Anyone, Ed Balls, obviously, but that's different. He wouldn't want to do it. Anyone who fancies themselves in the top job cannot be the person, the first one to go. And so what Straw I'm told happened yesterday.
And they underscored that yesterday when one of the rebels' officers said that an aide to one of them had rung up and said that their person was not going first, that they needed to produce a new name.
That's right. And so therefore they were all, the whole of the Parliamentary Labour Party and Cabinet were caught in this game of after you clause, where the PLP apparently was saying, look, if some Cabinet ministers resign, we'll sign up. And the Cabinet ministers were saying, I don't know if you've heard this, Allegra, but if 150 members of the PLP say, then we'll go. And everyone was saying, after you. And that you know, one ex-Cabinet minister I spoke to yesterday said that in the future, volumes of game theory will be written about to explain how was it a group of people ranging from the Compass left through to the Blairite right all wanted the same outcome, namely Brown gone, and it did not happen, and simply because of lack of coordination.
Well, again, I do think, watch this space.
I also suspect there is, even among Brown's critics, a real doubt that actually change of leadership will improve their prospects. And to a degree, looking from David Miliband's position, you may feel it harms your prospects, because actually what you're talking about now is degree of defeat and the ability to recover in time for the next election plus one. And actually, if you want to take over after a defeat, you need to be able to reinvent your party, apologise for past mistakes, set new directions. If you're trying to do that, half of it preceding a general election, half after, that means you have much greater problem. You know, Cameron's great ability was he came in, he could apologise for stuff, he wasn't overly linked to the past mistakes of the government, and he could, you know, for want of a better phrase, rebrand the Tories. If you're David Miliband or anybody of that generation...
I think that's right. And therefore, if the rational thing to do would be say, let's suck up and take this defeat, and then we can do the rebranding. The thing that worries them is the scale of the defeat. Because even somebody like David Miliband is thinking, if we go down to a 150-seat landslide, actually the kind of things that Tom is talking about, reinvigorate, they're for the birds, because we're going to spend 15, 20 years coming back. And so I think in an ideal world, if they thought they were going to lose by 30 seats, I think people would be saying, go ahead, Gordon. Knock yourself out. Lose this election with pleasure, and we'll come in afterwards. But they're not confident of that because they think it could be such a pounding. There'll be nothing left to inherit.
Can we just dwell for a minute on David Miliband? I mean, my reading of this is that he's scuppered his own plan, whatever it is, whether it is indeed to kind of somehow try and step down sometime before the election. He now looks like a cynical plotter. He's done this before. He gave an interview to The Guardian where he said, I could have walked if I wanted to, but didn't walk. And now he's saying, I'm working with Gordon Brown.
Why does he look cynical, Tom?
Because it looks like he's making a calculation. This is what
Wrong with making a calculation? That's what politics is.
Yes, but you don't be seen to do it. Tony Blair wouldn't have been seen to do it.
Well, then he's called a plotter. Then he's called someone who does something.
Hold on, you spring a surprise.
How do we know he's not springing a surprise? What evidence do we have?
Well, no, I'm saying even if he is springing a surprise, wouldn't it have been better to spring that surprise yesterday? At a point where it would have more chance.
But that brings us back to how ill coordinated it is, because they didn't know. And they were talking to, I think, not Hoon and Hewitt. They were talking to cabinet ministers, but it was...
Who's they?
The people. My understanding is that Charles Clarke knew ages ago, obviously, everybody knows that. Barry Shearman's office is going around saying that it was a surprise to them. Well, rather, Barry is saying it's a surprise to him, but his office told me that he knew 24 hours ago, and they thought it was just Hoon on their own. In as much that it is badly done, it seems like the one hand is barely communicating with the other. I totally think that is an accurate appraisal of this plot, other plots that have come and gone. But I also think that, I mean, if you are David Miliband, do you necessarily want to be associated with this lot?
I think Allegra's making a very important point here, which is about these statements and the lukewarm and her warning to us to watch this space. I'm taking seriously, because the lukewarm statements do intrigue me, because I sort of think either you do or you don't. If you're in one of these positions, you either fully back the Prime Minister so that no one can accuse you of disloyalty, or you don't and you join the plot. To have given the lukewarm endorsement does beg a question. Why would Alistair Darling or David Miliband be doing that unless they on some level wanted to hedge their bets? And are they thinking, and what Allegra's telling us perhaps suggests maybe this is more imminent than we thought, that in a few days' time things may change and they don't want to have earlier words thrown back at them. So maybe there is some bet hedging going on that we should perhaps take more seriously.
And if you've got a very delicate positioning problem with being seen to be Blairite, Brownite, whatever you want to call, that we all know is not necessarily fair, but are you quite useful pieces of shorthand, then you have to do the opposite to what we're calling for them to do now, which is act quickly and be seen to be involved in something coordinated. Do you not have to say, well, hold on a second, let's let this dry out for a while, see where the land lies, talk to people who were very upset by yesterday? You know, the grassroots were very upset. We got, you know, people referring to Hazel Blears. This is another Hazel Blears. I mean, you know, people who backed the June plot are, you know, were writing emails within 5 minutes saying, I completely support Gordon Brown. It's really sent people off in really unexpected directions, and to that extent was ill-conceived.
Well, to watch the malady lingering on, and it certainly sounds like we should continue to watch it, follow Andrew Sparrow's blog on the Guardian Politics website. Well, maybe this plot, like previous ones, will soon be forgotten. Maybe not. But what won't be forgotten for certain is the looming general election, which I'm afraid is grinding inevitably closer and will be for several months in all likelihood. At the start of the week, it seemed as if the election had already started. In set-piece press conferences, Alistair Darling and David Cameron exchanged questionable claims about the size of the black holes in each other's plans. And despite all those weeks of Christmas pudding, journalists lapped it up. But have they already picked their candidates? Will Woodward reflects on whether the reporters we rely on to tell us the truth are simply reflecting their familiar prejudices.
The Guardian called it right, of course, its verdict that Labour had drawn first blood. But elsewhere, what we used to call Fleet Street diverged wildly and went very much back to their own core votes. My old paper, the Daily Mirror, printed the best of the Darling dossier not as claims, but as the truth. The Independent reported a feverish day and sat painfully on the fence. The Times, not for the first time, played it slightly too clever for its own good by covering everything but the news. But the Mail, the Telegraph, and Cameron's new best mates at the Sun delivered Andy Coulson perfect scripts. Darling in dodgy dossier ding-dong, said the Sun. Tories ridicule Labour attack on spending, said the Torygraph, with no more than about five paragraphs on the marriage row. Darling's dodgy dossier leaves Labour in disarray, said the Mail, with nothing at all on the marriage slip. But the next day, they covered the marriage story with a page lead that suggested Paul Dacre, its editor, had had a quiet word at morning conference. It is all, in short, as if Tony Blair had never happened. A traditional left-right split in the papers with, crucially, News International more right than left. The old papers, dead tree journalism, are less important than they were, no doubt about it. But it means that Brown can have a good day, and yet it still feel like a defeat.
So, most of the papers are Tory. It really is back to the old days. But, Johnny, are they leading or following public opinion? That's the question, isn't it?
Well, there's, you know, papers like The Sun always want to be on the same page as their readers, and they do tend to follow, actually. It's one of those odd things that people always believe they shape opinion, and actually the data in terms of the voting habits of their readers suggests that actually they're led by their readers. And I think that was a big part of Murdoch's decision originally to back Blair, was he felt some readers were moving in that direction anyway, and moving towards New Labour as then was. So I think they probably do follow. In this case, they smell blood. They think that Brown's vulnerable and unpopular as an individual, mm-hmm. and therefore they're going after him. I think it's very interesting. The reversion to type has two interesting things about it. The first is the big comparison that people always make with 1992 and Labour's hope that somehow they can pull off a 1992, the incumbent unfancied behind in the polls that somehow wins. That worked for the Tories because they had the press on their side despite everything in 92, and the press was hugely hostile to Neil Kinnock. That condition is absolutely not in place now. The press is not calling David Cameron unelectable. If David Cameron's elected, will the last person left in Britain turn off the lights? There's not going to be anything like that. So that gives a huge advantage and may make the difference between why a 1992 scenario is impossible this time and what happened last time. And the other point is just for Brown personally. He worked so hard to cultivate Paul Dacre and the Daily Mail over years and years and years. And yet there's the Mail turning against him. And it just shows you how pragmatic some of these newspaper editors are, really. In the end, they do like backing a winner, or at least being where they think their readers are. And
it's
so that's going to hurt.
I heard that Dacre is away. He's on holiday this week. That's why they... I think they're personal friends, aren't they? Him and Brown.
Yes. Yeah.
But also that he really can't bear Cameron. He feels... So I think there is probably... as in all newspapers, a bit of a tussle between him, the beating heart of the Daily Mail, and then the people who actually put it together, and that would include, you know, deputy editors and their journalists and the like. So it's there's a kind of everyday output, which, as you say, is probably wanting to sidle up to the next government. But then there's the keeper of the Daily Mail soul, that is Paul Dacre, and he, I've been told by their reporters in the lobby, you know, he has a problem with David Cameron, and he has a problem with Andy Coulson. He thinks that that kind of flashy, metropolitan, slick kind of conservatism is not his kind of political value set. And
that Brown actually fits him, his values better.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. You know, likes books, like, you know, family man, real family. Well, Cameron is a real family man, but, you know, Brown is.
What are you saying, Allegra?
I know. Oh God, what do I know? What have I
revealed? Allegra's breaking your man's views here. Right.
But you know, anyway, so Cameron and Coulson are not liked by Dacre at all.
But Tom, I mean, regardless of where these papers end up, even when they're kind of half being kind to Labour, whether it's the Mail in 2007 or the Sun in 1997, they're still at heart conservative papers, aren't they? They're never banging the drum day in, day out on a Labour agenda as the Daily Mirror is.
Will's entirely right. If you're behind and you're launching attack after attack on your opposition party, you're much helped if that attack is consistently picked up by the majority of newspapers. So that's a real problem for Labour, even though the papers are less important than they were. They still set a lot of the political weather. You know, and it's coupled with two problems that are related to that, is that, you know, unlike Tony Blair, Brown is not a great communicator on TV. So in reality, TV is the most important media.
Yes, therefore that makes the papers matter more, you're right, because you
terms
can't
of a general election.
Catch up with television.
Yeah. And secondly, the Labour Party, as David Blunkett, you know, made clear recently, have no money. So actually the means by which they can actually directly contact voters, they're unable to do. You know, their phone banks are as bankrupt as, you know, the national banks, and, you know, they are not piling leaflets through constituents' doors in the key seats, as, you know, the Tory candidates are.
They're not,
you know,
Tom, but what about the new media? I mean, is it old-fashioned for us as part of the newspaper club to be sat here and thinking this is how people get their news?
They're just not very effective, their websites. They're those who either they're outriders or who are actually Labour list.
Jeff Hoon's on the line, Allegra. You better pick up.
Raise my head to try and see the number. I can't believe you could tell.
But you know, I think new media will be very interesting in the election. Clearly it will be more important, but you know, there's a symbol, you know, one of our colleagues mentioned this morning to us that Jeff Hoon, while getting ready to send his email to all members of the PLP, sent a blank one before he managed to cut and paste his message.
It's slightly embarrassing to do
but that also, is absolutely the perfect metaphor for that coup, isn't it, that it was firing blanks in the most literal sense.
It's terrible.
Tom was in the middle of a point. Tom, yeah. Old, weren't you, Tom?
I think so, yes. So I think that new media might be important, but I suspect it won't have as big a role as in the States, because the closed party system means that it's much, much harder for people to get involved.
Allegra, I'm just going to ask you one more question.
I wanted to make one more point about brings us back to the earlier discussion, which was about the sort of effectiveness of the Labour Party machine, even though it's broke. The document they produced on Monday, which was the $34 billion credibility gap, put to one side the jokes, which are not very funny, about, well, actually, the government has a kind of $178 billion credibility gap. It was a really good document. It was probably one of the most thorough pieces of work they've put together. It's really chunky. It's a great journalistic resource. It's got loads and loads of sources, which is very unusual. And it was really thorough. And that sort of brings us back to the question of, you know, this was a party that felt it might be getting on the front foot.
So there's a bit of fight left there, yeah.
That specific point Allegra makes was picked up to me by frustrated people yesterday and in the plot environment, who were saying, what this shows you is we really could, you know, win this, not just to stave off defeat. We could be winning this thing if only we had the right leader. And they do believe that they have the arguments. They have that Cameron's incredibly vulnerable. They believe that, you know, if even we with Gordon at the top could land these serious punches with the dossier on Monday, imagine what it would be like if we had somebody really good communicator at the top. So that partly explains this sort of steam coming out of the ears, frustration that ministers feel.
And I think the other thing to say is I don't think necessarily it is about a leader. Obviously, it necessarily has to be about a leader. But I think that as important will be a team. I think that it won't. I don't think it'll be one guy. I think we're going to have if for anything to come of this particular weak moment, we need a new coalition, basically, because you need all bits of the party feeling like they've been listened to, because this is going to be so traumatic. This has already been very traumatic for people.
Well, on that bombshell note of speculation, I'm going to say that's it for this week. So thanks very much to Jonathan Friedland and Tom Happold for coming in and joining us. And also thanks to Francesca Panetta for producing. So it's goodbye from me, and over in Westminster,
it's goodbye from me.